Did you want to continue with such your observations?
No.
Or?
Okay.
How much information did you share with the ambassadors and the political officers of the embassy, generally?
Oh,
yeah.
Sure. All the time.
Uh-huh.
All the time.
Was information ever withheld from them, or was there, or was that not even a question, not even an issue that came up?
Nothing from the ambassador.
Uh-huh.
Occasionally from the rest of the embassy staff, the senior staff. Uh-huh. But nothing was ever withheld from the ambassador.
Uh-huh. How would you describe the political situation in Iran during the late 50s?
The late 50s was a period of growth, and I think that there was a fair amount of, I would say, a generally optimistic atmosphere in the country, because greater prosperity was actually in sight, was mm-hmm. developing. I'll give you an illustration. When I first came there, you know, we had these morning holidays called Muharram in Iran, where everybody puts on black shirts and people beat themselves and whatnot. Well, after Muharram, in the middle 50s or 58, so you saw many people wearing those black shirts right on after this morning holiday, because they didn't have any other shirts. Well, during the late 50s, you found that people began to acquire more ordinary shirts, so that that period of making use of these one-purpose shirts sort of noticeably declined. You could see this in the sort of coloration of crowds and whatnot. So there was a growing prosperity. People began to have bicycles. People began to have little radios. All this, I think, was giving people a certain lift at that time, optimism.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of work underway on the big projects, dams and highways and all that kind of thing that was an organization activities.
So you saw the political situation as more or less stable because of the economic prosperity?
Yes, I think I've been really, I think that with the development of a sort of middle class, which grew enormously under the Shah, I mean, it's a tremendous expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Of the middle class, as you probably know, middle classes cause trouble everywhere. Growing middle class means growing aspirations and sort of personal demands, and that began to develop in the 60s. There was that element of the sort of intellectuals, socialist leaning into intellectuals, the kind of element that, for example, Dick Cottam would promote this. But in the late 50s, they certainly were not.
Mm-hmm.
Not significant.
Mm-hmm. Was Cottam on your staff at this point? I think he was there in the 50s to 58 or so. So there was a brief period when he was on your. Was he interested in those groups at that point too?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And there was debate over that, and within the station over who should be supported or.
Well, there was discussion and issues like that. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Also, George Cave was with you, I think, in this period.
Yeah.
Did he do political reporting as well, or?
Yes. Very effective man.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Now back to this question of political stability. How strong was the Shah's position at this point in the late 50s?
Well, I think that he had the total support at that time of the armed forces and National Gendarmerie and the police structure. This position was strong. And also because at that time economic activity was developing, so that people were getting jobs and interesting jobs in the town organization and other government agencies, the Huzestan Development Project, and the major projects of that kind.
How confident was he about his position? The Shah about his position?
Yes. Well, I would say that's a difficult thing to estimate. He gave the impression of being quite confident. Mm-hmm. But he was always pushing for greater increased military supplies and that kind of thing, building up a greater military capacity. I think that reflected not so much the lack of confidence, just as ambition.
Did you see vulnerabilities in his position at this point, in the late 50s?
Well, weaknesses in his reasoning, but not vulnerabilities. I would say weaknesses in his reasoning.
In terms of what kind of weaknesses?
Well, these ambitions were really beyond sort of the logical prospects for the future.
In terms of resources?
Yes.
Resource availability.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
So how visible was the opposition to the Shah at this point, say 57 through 59, 60, late 50s?
How visible? They certainly were not a prominent political force of any kind, not a political force. But I think they were known to everybody. They weren't an underground force. The only underground was the Kuomintang, I would say, at that time.
Leaving aside the question of the Kuomintang for a minute, how much contact did the agency's staff have with some of the opposition figures at this time?
Quite a bit, I think. I think that the Shah was really quite worried about
by your contacts.
Always afraid that perhaps they might win more American support than he was getting.
Listening to the contacts with the remnants of the old of the Mossadegh organization,
right.
The National Funders.
National Funders. Jepay and Nili, as it's called.
Pardon me?
Or the Jepay and Nili, as it's called in Britain. National Funders.
Did the Shah express did he express apprehension about these contacts with when meetings with you?
Yes.
And how did you respond to his concerns?
That he should be happy rather than distressed about the fact that somebody is keeping aware of what these people are doing.
Mm-hmm. he was
talking. He knows what U.S. policy is, that it is to support him, and that kind of thing can only help us support him better if somebody knows what's going on. Mm-hmm.
Was he convinced by that?
Half convinced,
yeah.
I'd say.
Now, how much concern did you have about the influence of the Tujie, the local communist party?
Not too much. I think that they've been really dealt with quite effectively by the sort of smashed there. And I don't think that they've been very significant.
According to one recent account, by the early 1950s, U.S. and British intelligence had agents at the highest levels of the Tujie organization. Was this still true in the late 50s?
I think so. Uh-huh. Yes.
So you were well apprised of their interest and activities.
I think that, I think at that time they were really inconsequential.
Mm-hmm. Before I ask you. Now, in the spring of 1958, some months after you arrived, General Wali Karani, among others, was arrested and charged with planning a coup against the Shah. How much did you learn about this episode?
I really don't recall too much. I don't recall much about that. The thing, I think, was fairly inconsequential, and I don't think that the plot was very serious. Yes, I had any remote chance of succeeding.
Did you know Karani?
I knew
him.
I thought I didn't know him well.
Someone suggested that he had a vision of himself as an Iranian Nasser. Did that make sense in any way?
Not. I think he could have pictured himself as such, but it's rather ludicrous image that he could have himself. I've even forgotten whether he was the Army G2. I think he was G2 in the Army.
I think, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I read that one of the reasons that he was arrested was that he had prepared a long report charging Tamer Bakhtiar, among other military leaders, charging them with corruption. Did you hear anything about that? That he had information on certain individuals that made him somewhat dangerous?
I just don't recall. Mm-hmm. They were all sort of, the Shah had this group of people in powerful positions, all of whom were inclined to cast aspersions on each other in their jockeying for the position and for the Shah's favor. Eventually, the Shah had to can them quite a lot, as you may remember, because it period when several of them were locked up.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, from what I've read, the Shah accused the U.S. of complicity with the alleged coup plot. Did he bring this up with you?
I don't recall any serious crisis developing about that question.
Yeah.
He talked about it, but he didn't. If he brought it up, it wasn't in such a forceful way as to impress me as being something serious in his mind as far as we're concerned.
Mm-hmm. Now, according to a report by George Bundy that was written in 1961, during the late 1950s, this is a quote, several key conservative generals had at one time or the other approached the British and the U.S. for help in plots to overthrow the Shah, with some civilian help. Did any generals make veiled approaches towards you about this issue?
No. Nobody did, and as far as to me, and I think they would, I would be the kind of person they would come to. They talked about corruption of the others, I think that was about it.
Now, July 58.
But that was. Probably the basis for the arrest of several powerful figures and the exile of Bakhtiar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, some months later, in July 58, a military coup overturned the monarchy in neighboring Iraq.
Yes.
Were you in Iran?
I was in Iran.
At that time?
Yes.
What kind of impact did the coup have on the Shah's frame of mind?
It shook the Shah. It shook the Shah quite badly. He was thoroughly worried by that, and I think began to examine his own structure, his own apparatus, to see what threats might be residing within his own structure.
To what extent did you share that concern? Or do you think he was exaggerating the problem?
I thought that as far as Iran was concerned, he was exaggerating the problem. It was after that event that his former son-in-law, Ardashir Zahedi, decided to sleep outside the Shah's door to protect him in the event of a coup. Dramatic gesture by Ardashir. Put a mattress outside the Shah's bedroom door and sleep. But that did shake the Shah.
Mm-hmm. From what I've seen of the embassy's telegrams from that summer 58, after the coup in Iraq,
yes,
the embassy seemed to be more worried about the internal opposition to the Shah, not only from the National Fronters, most of that grouping, but also from conservatives, as well as the officer corps. What do you recall about the political atmosphere in the country around that time?
Lots of sort of agitated discussion of mm-hmm. of the situation, but I just don't recall that we were really terribly concerned mm-hmm. in the embassy at that time. Mm-hmm. Of course, after that, I think that we began to do a lot of thinking about what the Shah could do to improve his image in the country, and how one could undertake a series of programs that would impress the people with the fact that something useful was being done, and that. That's when things like the land reform mm-hmm. came up, and the education corps, and the medical corps, and using army units for building roads for isolated villages, and building schools and hospitals in rural areas, and that kind of thing.
But as far as you could tell, there was this mention about the officer corps and the telegrams that I saw.
Yes.
They're concerned about their attitudes. As far as you could tell, the officer corps was basically loyal to the Shah's.
Yes.
Now, in the months after the coup, the U.S. increased its military supply programs to Iran.
Yes.
And there was also negotiation of a bilateral defense agreement, which I think was signed in early 59. Now, apparently the text of this agreement, this bilateral defense agreement, fell short of the Shah's expectation. I think he expected stronger guarantees
yes.
for his internal position. Yes. Did he discuss this point with you, his feelings about the agreement and what it should involve?
He must have done, but I don't recall the details. He was always concerned that our support was not firm enough, and definite enough, and I think he expected to commit ourselves to sort of come in with full force if be threatening in the way. And I think that later he was concerned that he didn't support Pakistan more. And in about Kashmir and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't have a clear recollection of discussions about that question.
Mm-hmm. Now, the agreement itself was signed during a CENTO meeting that was held in Pakistan in early 59.
Yes.
And while the meeting was taking place, a Soviet delegation arrived in Tehran to negotiate a non-aggression treaty with the country.
Yes.
And this aggression, non-aggression treaty would include an Iranian promise not to negotiate an agreement, a bilateral agreement, with the United States. But soon after the Soviets arrived, the Shah said he was ill, and the Prime Minister left town, leaving no one for the Soviets to talk to.
Yes.
What did you make of this, of these developments? Do you recall?
I recall that situation, and I think it was just an evasive maneuver by the Iranians not to get pushed into that type of commitment.
Did the Shah tell you, did the Shah discuss his purposes in inviting the Soviet delegation in any meetings with you? Did he?
He talked about it. I think he the sort of invitation was a fair suggestion that they must have asked through their ambassador that they be invited. This happened, but I really can't say that. I thought it was a great
thing. Well, to what extent did you or other onlookers worry that the Shah might be exploring the possibility of non-alignment?
We were thinking about that, yes. That was a concern.
But not terribly strong?
Not terribly strong, because I think we felt that he was already too dependent. I think that thought was put out. He talked in a way to suggest that, because I think he hoped that would provide more military aid.
Would it lead to apprehension on the U.S.'s part, which would lead to more assistance?
Yeah. Yeah. I think he used that device quite often.
Now, according to an embassy cable from a few years later, ambassadors from the U.S. and other NATO countries, this is a quote, blocked the proposed Soviet-Iran agreement. Do you recall whether this happened or?
Don't recall. Yeah.
Well, I guess this question speaks to the point you made a minute ago. In a January 59 cable, Ambassador Wales argued that the Shah was trying to blackmail the United States when he engaged and talked to the Soviets. Did you see it that way?
Yes. Yeah. It's in essence what I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Right. I think he used that device very often.
Now, for the documents that I've seen, it seems that by mid-1960 or so, concern in Washington about the Shah's position had increased considerably. According to a June 1960 NSC paper, because of widespread dissatisfaction among the middle classes with the Shah's system of personal rule, the possibility of internal upheaval cannot be dismissed. To what extent did you share this concern yourself?
I thought that put it a little bit strongly. More strongly than the situation at that time justified, but with this growing middle class, there were more and more people who wanted to have a say in what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When these NSC papers were prepared, did you see the early draft versions? Were they sent to Tehran for your review? Or?
They probably were, but I just haven't read.
Yeah, yeah. Now, according to the same NSC report, one of the sources of discontent with the Shah was that, this is a quote, that the business activities, general irresponsibility, and in some cases, outright corruption of some members of the royal family, civil service, the high military command, all these problems led to discontent among the middle classes. How much of these problems did you know about yourself? Questions of corruption among the Shah's family, or alleged corruption?
I knew.
Yeah.
Talk about it.
Yeah.
I once raised the question with him directly about members of his family engaging in this sort of 5% of deals and so on, and he said, well, they have very limited allowances from me, and they just have to go out into the business world on their own. Persian type of reply, but so he was obviously aware that other people felt about the royal family taking advantage of its position, and generally there was a lot of discontent about that. Wasn't this corruption around the court and so on, which was really quite bad.
Did you report on this back to Washington? Did you send reports on these matters to Washington?
As far as I remember.
And one interview subject told me that he believed that the Shah encouraged a certain amount of financial corruption because then he could hold something over those who were engaged in it. Does that ring true in some ways?
I think it was a method of acquiring control. And this happened with senior military figures and other and government figures in general.
Now again, this question of the attitude of the military surfaces again in 1960. And this NSC paper also noted, in quote, the dependability of an army support of the Shah remains somewhat uncertain. And then Ridgway Knight, the State Department, commented upon that statement. He said that there was more cause to worry about a military coup than a popular anti-Shah revolution. To what extent would you have agreed with that kind of an assessment?
I think
say
that,
by
that,
60?
Was, that, yeah. that was a correct evaluation of the time, because the Iranian officer corps was quite broadly based, quite astonishingly broadly based, and that among the among the more junior officers, there were a lot of people from the social circles where feeling against this would be very strong, against the corruption of the court and the people, highly placed people.
So military officers were reformist inclinations?
Yes.
Because of their apprehension?
That's right. And this broad base for the army is quite a special situation. In part, as people like that advanced, junior officers advanced, they came up into the higher levels where corruption became possible. But the sort of more junior people, I think, felt strongly about this.
Mm-hmm. Did your staff or have conversations with military people that gave them these ideas about the role of the junior officers? Now, one of the conclusions that the NSC paper made, that the Shah, he was to preserve his throne, the Shah needed to deal with corruption, move on social and economic reforms, like land reform, fiscal reform, and also allow more scope for freedom of political expression. But the NSC officials also agreed that if left to his own devices, the Shah was not likely to move quickly enough. From your own observations, how much interest did the Shah have in these kinds of internal reforms, say in the late 50s, early 60s?
He seemed to have a real interest, but not a pressing interest. Land reform was a real interest of his, and I think that he felt that there was a lot of public relations value to traveling around the country handing out deeds to peasants who knelt before him and kissed his shoes and that kind of thing. I've been on trips with him like that and have actually seen that sort of performance. But I think that he really didn't appreciate the importance of the other aspects of the program. And they never created a proper support base for the land reform, which I think is almost chronic in most countries for land reforms taking place.
Now, the NSC analysts observed that the U.S. had tactfully convinced the Shah to move in a constructive fashion, but not to press it so hard that he would turn against the United States. For
yes.
First, to what extent did you, or Ambassador Wales, make suggestions to the Shah about the need for internal change?
Suggestions were really made quite forcefully. Quite forcefully. And I think he was impressed, and things started to happen after that.
When you talked to the Shah about these issues, did you sort of raise the problems and say what kind of direction he should take, or how specific were you about the question of internal reform?
Well, one really talks about what are things that one might do. You know, saying you should do this, but what are things that might have quite an impact? Stress which thing might have an impact, and he gets the idea.
But he became more receptive to these suggestions.
Yes.
Over time.
Yeah.
Now, in the same period, in 1960, the Christian Science Monitor ran a story about purported contacts between U.S. embassy officials, U.S. oil companies, and opposition leaders and members. And around the same time of this Christian Science Monitor story, Walter Lippmann wrote a rather critical article about the Shah and Iran's prospects. Now, from what I've seen in the documents, apparently the Shah believed that because the members of the consortium opposed his independent negotiations with Enrico Matti of Italy's ENI, they were running a campaign to destabilize his position. And he also claimed that the oil companies were responsible for demonstrations by students, Iranian students in the United States, against him when he visited the country from time to time. Now, this raises a lot of questions, all these various charges, counter charges. Did the Shah complain to you about this press coverage in the oil companies' contact with opposition, or reported contact with opposition figures? Did he bring this up with you?
I don't recall his having talked specifically about political action taken by the oil companies, but he did speak about his concern about the possible effects of their opposition, because bringing in the Italians, he really hit the oil company profits very, very hard, and that was really the first great change in the position of Iran with respect to its oil resources.
So the consortium members discussed these developments with you, that they expressed their apprehension about the negotiations with the Italians?
Right.
And I guess later on there were independent talks with Standard Oil of Indiana.
Yes.
That followed the Italian negotiations.
Yes. Yes.
So the Shah merely discussed his concern about the reaction to these negotiations,
yes.
But that's about
as
far as it went. Okay. And also in 1960, the Shah announced that there would be elections based on party competition for seats in the Majlis. I guess we had not had elections for some years. appealed his decision to hold on in 1916. Right. Did the Shah explain to you why he had decided to take the step to hold new elections based on party competition?
Oh, it was just efforts to democratize the regime and to still some of the some of the sort of feeling against autocratic rule.
To what extent were these elections held partly because of suggestions made by you or Ambassador Wales to open up things a bit, or was there?
Well, I think that it was clear to him that this was felt to be a good idea on the part of our government.
Mm-hmm. Now, the elections were held in the summer of 1960, and the two official parties, were more or less controlled by the Shah's appointees,
right,
ended up in control of Parliament. And that led to charges that the election had been rigged. And there were some protests with members of the National Front joining the protests. Now, then the Shah nullified the election, dismissed Prime Minister Iqbal,
yes,
and replaced him with Sheriff Imami, yes, who had some ties to the National Fronters and the religious community.
Yes, he comes from a religious family.
Now, how surprised are the Shah for the protests against the election? Did he express any concern about this?
I just don't remember. Yeah. I don't remember that. Sharif Imami lives in New York. If you'd like to talk to him, he's an interesting chap. He's really mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did he explain to you his decision to nullify the elections? Does that?
Yes, but I don't recall what they were. Yeah. It was obviously to stem criticism of having fixed the whole thing up.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. You knew Sheriff Imami at this time?
Yes, I know him well.
What were your impressions of him at that point? If you can separate the present from the past. Yeah.
Somebody who's trying hard to do what his monarch would like him to do,
uh-huh, uh-huh,
is totally succeeding. He's fundamentally quite a nice man, but was in a difficult position.
Now, Sheriff Imami, he held new elections,
yes,
which were apparently somewhat less rigged. And the result was a majority which was less amenable to the Shah's control. And there some National Fronters had won seats,
yes,
in a few spots. And there were more protests against the Shah. Was there any concern that the Shah might be losing a little bit of control out of the domestic situation?
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Now, November 1960, of course, John F. Kennedy was elected president. Did the Shah discuss the elections and the results of the elections with you? Do you recall any discussions of Kennedy or Nixon?
I mean, he would have, and undoubtedly did, but I don't recall it. Really, what his reaction?
He didn't express any disappointment that Nixon lost?
No. He was pretty cautious about things like that.
Now, how would you describe the Kennedy administration's approach to Iran, as you understood it?
Well, I think, as I recall, there was a lot of Bobby Kennedy's influence at that time, and he was more in time toward the National Front and elements of that kind. But it all reflected itself in a certain amount of correspondence and discussion between the embassy in Washington, but no changes in policy.
So there was basic continuity between Eisenhower and Kennedy in their general approach?
Yes, there was, I think.
Apparently William Douglas, who had done a fair amount of traveling in Iran, he had some influence on Kennedy's thinking. Had you ever met Arendt during this? Had you ever met Douglas during this?
No, no, never did. But you mean this is Justice?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Supreme Court Justice Douglas.
My impression from the character of his visits was that he would actually come away with a very sort of narrow and superficial interpretation. He is, I think his contacts are very narrowly based, and had no opportunity to get a really broad picture.
According to one recent book, the Shah developed over time a personal dislike of Kennedy.
How much truth? I never, never saw him in the station of that.
I've also read that Kennedy did not have particularly high regard for the Shah. Did you get any sense of that?
No.
At your level?
I never did.
Apparently, the Shah had some apprehension about Kennedy's attitude, and according to a cable that Holmes sent later in 61, this awareness troubles him, and is part, at least, of the explanation for his recurrent moods of depression, which demands reassurance on our part. Did you and Holmes talk about that problem, or the Shah's feelings about the Kennedys?
Yes, we did. And the Shah's feeling of insecurity about sort of continuing American support. That's what he wanted, was unqualified support for whatever he chose to do. But he was a somewhat insecure man, I would say.
In terms of insecurity about his position of power, or personal insecurity?
Yeah, his position of power.
Did that how often did that manifest itself in discussions that you would have with him, where you would allude to this, to his fears?
It came up fairly often. Anytime the Russians made some significant move that might impact on Iran, his business with Pakistan and Kashmir and all that brought out that insecurity in him.
Okay. Now, during the course of 61, the National Front was operating more and more openly, from what I've read. And according to the report by Stuart Rockwell, the Shah had an almost psychopathic fear of the National Front as a political force. That's a quote.
Yes.
Why did the Shah let the National Front operate fairly openly during this period, if that was his fear?
I think he felt that he had to. Because of the general criticism of his suppression of opposition, he had to allow some manifestation of freedom to take place.
What was your own assessment of the National Front and its leadership? What was your appraisal of this group?
I think rather an impractical group of intellectuals who have a kind of idealized concept of how one how governments function, and whose ideas were not really too pertinent to the actual time that we were talking about. I think that they would have probably created a weakened Iran's position if they had come into power.
I think some